террористов, убийц, не людей.
Террористов, murderers, non-humans who do not and cannot have a nationality face one unenviable fate: retribution and oblivion. They have no future.
Russian President Vladimir Putin addressing his country Saturday, the day after gunmen stormed a concert hall outside Moscow, setting the building on fire and killing more than 130 people. An offshoot of the Islamic State terrorist organization claimed responsibility for the attack, but that hasn't stopped Putin from trying to spin the tragedy to his political advantage by claiming without evidence that Ukraine was responsible. In the past few days, graphic leaked videos show the suspects being tortured, and they appeared in a courtroom bruised and bandaged on Sunday. One of them was half conscious in a wheelchair holding a catheter. We're going to talk about what such public displays of torture say about the state of Russian society and the normalization of political violence in that country with Max Boot. He's a columnist who covers national security for The Washington Post. And a warning, this conversation does include descriptions of violence. Max, welcome to Press Play.
Thanks for having me.
You know, the four suspected gunmen appeared in court showing signs of abuse, and videos of their torture had circulated on Russia's social media channels previously. One had part of his ear cut off and put in his mouth and told to eat it. Really just horrific things. What went through your mind when you saw or learned about this? Were you surprised?
Not terribly. I mean, this is a very violent regime that inflicts great suffering on completely innocent people. For example, the citizens of Ukraine. So not a huge surprise that when they actually have purported terrorists who have supposedly carried out this massacre of more than 130 people, that they are extremely brutal. There's no, you know, there's no Miranda warnings in Russia. There's no Supreme Court that enforces the rights of criminal defendants. And I think what you're seeing is basically the security forces are trying to deflect blame from their own performance and that of their supreme leader, Vladimir Putin, because they failed to stop this attack. And so now, in the aftermath of the attack, they're acting with horrific brutality to convey some kind of vengeance or justice to the Russian people, when in fact, their rank incompetence is what's responsible for all the people who were killed, despite the U.S. warnings.
Right. Do we know anything about how ordinary Russians have responded to this violence?
I don't. I mean, I think it's very hard to gauge that because they don't have a lot of sources of outside information. And of course, they're being fed propaganda on all the state media channels. And the propaganda line is basically that, yes, you know, these attackers may be, you know, radical Islamists, but they were supposedly sent by Ukraine or the United States or some other nefarious force. And again, this is all nonsense. This is ridiculous. I mean, Islamic State has claimed credit for the attack, and the U.S. intelligence community and other intelligence services have said that they believe Islamic State is responsible. But Putin wants to use this to justify his horrific assault on Ukraine, and again, to deflect blame from his own incompetence, the fact that his regime is very good at repressing peaceful dissidents and killing dissidents like Alexei Navalny, but their inability to stop an actual terrorist attack has been brutally revealed.
Yeah. I mean, just to go back to how the state has responded, the prime minister said the suspects deserve no mercy. Former President Dmitry Medvedev said everyone involved should be killed. And the military interrogators who are believed to have tortured the suspects received awards for bravery. I mean, what does this tell us about the state of political violence and in Russia and, you know, the celebration of it?
Well, it's a criminal regime that has perpetrated great violence against so many people over the years, from Russians who dare to criticize Putin to people in Syria or Chechnya or now in Ukraine. It's just it's a mafia state that shows no restraint in the use of force and is not bound by democratic norms. It's not bound by the rule of law or any constitution. Basically, it's a thugocracy, and I think you're seeing that play out here.
Yeah. I mean, it seems hard to imagine that folks aren't becoming somewhat desensitized to this. But, you know, you had mentioned the death of opposition leader Alexei Navalny. I'm curious, like, do you see this as related or connected in terms of the regime being emboldened to use violence?
Well, I think, you know, the Putin regime has used violence since day one because Putin really solidified his role at, you know, beginning in 2000 by waging this horrific war against Chechnya and, you know, rallying the Russian people against Chechnya. And of course, since then, he has, you know, invaded Georgia. He's invaded Ukraine twice. He's undertaken terror bombing of Syria. So, you know, the whole regime is underpinned by force and the threat of force. There is no political or legal legitimacy, I would say, to the Putin regime. It's the basic, its basic pitch is that if you cooperate with the thugs who run the Kremlin, you can make some money. And if you don't cooperate, you will get crushed. That's the essential message of the Putin regime.
I mean, on the other hand, we did see hundreds of mourners come out for Navalny's memorial services. Well, hundreds were arrested, actually. More than that were there. What does that tell you, if anything, about sort of where the Russian people are at? And do you see that there's been more of a crackdown in recent years?
There's definitely been an increased crackdown, especially since Putin launched his invasion of Ukraine in 2022. You know, before then, there was some cracks in his authoritarian facade. And since then, there is really no room for any kind of dissent or differing opinion. A lot of more liberal, younger Russians have gone into exile, and you've seen what happens to those who try to protest the regime. And yet, as we saw with the mourners at Navalny's funeral, the dream of freedom dies hard. And there are still a lot of Russians who oppose the war and want a better life, but it's very hard for them to make their voices felt because, you know, Putin is in such complete control of the entire country.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to let you go, Max, without mentioning American journalist Evan Gerskovich, who's now been in Russian jail for almost exactly a year. Given what we've seen happen to these four suspected terrorists, do you think he could be more at risk for maybe not as brutal of a treatment, but harsher treatment than certainly in a pre-war Russia?
I don't think there's much connection between what's happened with those terrorists and what's going to happen to Evan. I suspect that Putin probably wants to keep Evan in decent shape because he sees Evan as a pawn to be traded for Russian prisoners in the West, for some of the assassins perhaps that Putin has sent to the West. So I don't, you know, I don't think he's going to deal with Evan the way he dealt with Navalny or other prisoners. But of course, you know, just being in jail in Russia it must be a horrific experience and truly Kafkaesque because obviously Evan did nothing wrong. He's just a victim of this brutal, awful dictatorship, which will stop at nothing to get what it wants.
All right, we will leave it there. Max Boot is a columnist who covers national security for the Washington Post. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, Scott Peterson was convicted 20 years ago of murdering his wife, Lacey, and their unborn son. Now he's back in court asking for a new look at the evidence. And muralist Judy Baca is the subject of a new LA Times documentary. Her seminal work, The Great Wall of LA, is set to double in size. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Marisa Lagos in for Madeline Brandt. The Scott Peterson trial gripped the nation. His wife, Lacey, who was 8 months pregnant, disappeared on Christmas Eve in 2002. Months later, her body was found washed ashore in the San Francisco Bay. A jury found Peterson guilty of two counts of murder, one for Lacey and one for their unborn son, Connor, and sentenced him to death. The California Supreme Court overturned his death sentence in 2020, so Peterson is currently serving life without parole. Now, Peterson's back in court this month, hoping to win a new trial. The LA Innocence Project is behind this effort, and they're prepared to present evidence they say was overlooked in his first trial. And they want DNA testing on items found around the Peterson's neighborhood. Joining us now is Vinny Politan. He's Emmy Award-winning legal journalist and lead anchor on Court TV. Vinny, welcome to Press Play.
Thanks so much for having me, Marisa.
Thanks for being here. Well, I think the big question people are probably asking now is what new evidence could be presented, is being presented, that could actually warrant a new trial?
Well, this is what their theory is on the Innocence Project. There was a burglary taking place in the neighborhood that day. And we heard about this years ago when the trial happened. Mm-hmm. And it was like, okay, there's a burglary, but what possible connection, what evidence would there be to Lacey Peterson? Now they're saying there was a van that was torched, right? Set on fire on purpose by someone less than a mile away from where Lacey disappeared in her house. Now this van, there was an investigation, but part of what they found inside the van apparently was a mattress that had some sort of a blood stain on it. And now they're saying we need to test the DNA from that mattress, from the torched van, which was less than a mile away from the Peterson's home, to see if that's Lacey's DNA, if Lacey was abducted by these burglars, murdered in the van, and then for some reason disposed of, you know, a couple hours away in San Francisco Bay by this burglary ring.
Wow. So
it's a lot, right?
It's a lot. Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, this was a case that riveted the nation. A young mom to be missing on Christmas Eve. Turns out her husband was having an affair. And I think the assumption in the public was he must have done it. Can you just take us back a little bit to what, you know, the world, how the world processed the disappearance of Lacey Peterson?
So she goes missing on Christmas Eve and it becomes a national story, the search for Lacey Peterson. And initially, Lacey's family, along with Scott, they are holding vigils and trying to get the word out, searching for Lacey. Where could she be? Because she's about to give birth to their son. And the search is on and she's not found. But at some point, the story becomes so big that his girlfriend, Amber Fry, who's not in Modesto, but lives hours away south of Modesto, it becomes a national story. And now all of a sudden, Amber finds out about it, sees Scott Peterson, says, wait a minute. This is the guy I've been dating. Mm-hmm. He didn't say he was married. So she does the right thing and comes forward and informs police. And then police start to record the conversations between Scott Peterson and Amber Fry. And this really starts to fuel the fire that, wait a minute, this guy, Scott Peterson, isn't who he says he is. And he's having this whole separate life with this other woman. So now you've got the motive. And I think at that point, public sentiment turned against Scott Peterson. Lacey's family turned against Scott Peterson. But still, there wasn't much evidence and they couldn't put the pieces together yet.
Right. Until her body is found washed ashore and actually as well as the baby she was carrying. I mean, talk about that discovery and what happens then.
Well, this is the key. To me, this is the key to the case. And we talk about the words circumstantial case. Well, there is one huge circumstance in this case. Scott Peterson's alibi for that morning was he drove from Modesto to San Francisco Bay in his little dinghy boat to go fishing on Christmas Eve while his wife was pregnant at home alone. Okay, that was his alibi. I had nothing to do with this. I was fishing. Here's my receipt. I'll show you that I went fishing. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, months later, that's where the bodies are recovered. So his alibi, which is more than 2 hours away from his home, which seemed kind of solid, I guess, from his perspective, all of a sudden becomes the scene of the crime because Lacey and Connor wash up in San Francisco Bay. So how on earth did they get there? Well, Scott Peterson has told us over and over again, that's where he was. That's where he went. So if she went missing and that's where she's found and that's where he went, oh my goodness, that is one huge circumstance in a circumstantial case. Now, can I just tie this in to what the arguments are being made here by Scott Peterson and the LA Innocence Project, which is these burglars are spotted by Lacey Peterson. So they go from being a burglar, who are people who go into houses when people aren't there because they don't want confrontation, right? Mm-hmm. And now they become kidnappers and abductors, and they abduct her and put her in a van, murder her in the van because they don't want to get caught for a burglary, right? You know, I'm going to commit murder because I don't want to get caught for a burglary. And then what is the explanation as to why these burglars would then drive more than 2 hours away to put the bodies there? Are they framing Scott Peterson, the manure salesman from Modesto, or is it a coincidence? Which one? Because neither one of them makes sense to me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm curious, before we go further into the legal case against Peterson, if you could talk a little bit about why you think this captured the nation's attention. I mean, people were so invested. It was definitely a water cooler conversation.
Well, first of all, they were a beautiful couple. Like, she's a beautiful woman. She's about to give birth. They're starting this family. And Scott Peterson, you know, good looking guy. And I think the initial attraction to the case was, well, who would do this to a woman who's about to give birth? Mm-hmm. This person has to be evil. And it was a search for a missing woman, hoping to find her alive somewhere. Right. So that's how it really began. The other part of this was that it was taking place in Modesto. Modesto had been sort of in the news recently around this time because of a congressman who had been having an affair with an intern who had been found dead in D.C. Gary right. Condit was a congressman from Modesto. So a lot of folks from Modesto were connected to members of the media. It's December 24th. The other thing in our business that we know is that it's a slow news cycle around Christmas. You know, there's no mm-hmm. politics. There's nothing happening. No one's passing laws. There's none of that is happening. So there's like this sort of moment in time in the news cycle. And then you've got the city is already connected to the national media, who jumped in very quickly on this one. And then it just took off. Once you knew the story, you became invested mm-hmm. in it because you wanted to know who would do this to this woman. And then once he became a suspect, wow.
Yeah. I mean, as you said, too, beautiful couple, white woman, you know, sort of I think they looked like, before all of this, sort of the American dream in a way. Right.
Yeah. He had a great life. Scott Peterson played college golf. His parents both had prior marriages with children, but together Scott was their only son. So he was like the golden child of his family. Lacey's mother loved her, or stepfather loved her so much. She had great close friends. The couple met in college. You know, it was a dream relationship, mm-hmm. which should have led to a dream life.
Yeah. So he does eventually get found guilty of these murders, despite the evidence being circumstantial. And he was initially sentenced to death. He spent almost 20 years on death row at San Quentin. And in 2021, he was resentenced to life without the possibility of parole. This was over complaints by his defense about a juror not sort of being honest about her past experiences. Well, and that brings us back to the Innocence Project's appeal, and just this kind of question I think a lot of people had when they first heard about this is, why of all the possible cases for the LA Innocence Project to get behind, is it this one?
I don't know. For the life of me, I don't know. And, you know, these arguments and evidence regarding the burglars, to me, those are reasonable doubt arguments that you make at a trial. His case is at a point now where you need evidence, new evidence that proves his innocence, not things that are like, well, it could have been this, it could have been that. That's what you do at the trial. You know, you just have to raise a reasonable doubt. You don't mm-hmm. have to prove anything at a trial. But now they've got to prove that there's something going on here. Now, I guess if they're able to get this DNA from this mattress, from this van that was torched less than a mile away from the house, you know, on the day that she went missing, or the day after she went missing, one of those 2 days, and they test the DNA and it matches Lacey Peterson. But yeah, they've got something. They've got something. And I don't know how the LA Innocence Project goes through and sort of figures out which ones they want to do. But like when Barry and Peter, Barry Shack, Peter Neufeld, founded the Innocence Project, this is when DNA was first starting. Back in the early 90s, and there were so many cases where there was actual DNA evidence that was found at the scene could never be tested, but now you could test it to see, hey, did these eyewitnesses really see who they say they saw? Were those circumstantial cases actually strong enough where we have some forensic evidence here that can scientifically say something? And that was the basis of it. So my guess is that's where the LA Innocence Project is going. But if they're just going on a fishing expedition and going to argue, you know, these reasonable doubt arguments, I think they're going to lose credibility. Right. However, and I never say never in anything, right? You have to keep your mind open at all times. If, and I think it's a huge if, there's a DNA match from a mattress in that van, that's a complete game changer. But that would mean that these burglars put her in the van and killed her, torched it, and then either tried to frame Scott Peterson or coincidentally dump the body the same place where Scott Peterson was fishing.
So if they succeed in getting this evidence tested and if there was a match, what would happen to Scott Peterson?
I think he would get a new trial. I think they'll get it tested, though. I think, you know, there may be a battle to see if it'll be permitted to happen. But I think if they win that argument and they test it, we'll see. But every other argument that they're making about, well, this evidence wasn't shown, this evidence wasn't shown, those are things for a trial court. Those are things for an appellate court. We're beyond that now. We're at the point where he's done, convicted, all his appeals are gone. Now you need new evidence that actually proves something. And in this case, arguably, a DNA match somewhere else could prove that Lacey Peterson was in that van. And that would mean that Scott Peterson may very well have had nothing to do with any of this.
All right. Vinnie Politan is a legal journalist and lead anchor on Court TV. And of course, they'll be following this case closely over there. Thanks, Vinnie.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on Press Play, KCRW's Life Examine host Jonathan Bastian is here. We'll have the news of the day, plus we'll learn about Silas White, the Black businessman who wanted to found the Ebony Beach Club in Santa Monica in the 1950s. The city took his land back then, and now the Santa Monica City Council will explore compensating his descendants. Coming up, LA artist Judy Baca is expanding her half-mile North Hollywood mural depicting untold California history. Hear all about its wild history.
We had a flood and the kids went down trying to save our materials and equipment. And one of our people got washed down the channel 6.5 miles. She has lived to tell that story.
That's next on Press Play. Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Marisa Lagos, in for Madeline Brand.
I never really seriously took myself in as an artist for many years. I mean, I didn't really want to say I was an artist, I think, until I was, you know, halfway through my career, in which I said, oh, I guess I am one, because I seem to be doing this over and over again.
Judy Baca may not have always seen herself as an artist, but her murals have decorated the buildings and walls of Los Angeles for decades. Most notably, the Great Wall of Los Angeles, a half-mile-long mural along a concrete flood control channel in North Hollywood that depicts California's history through the eyes of women and people of color. Judy Baca grew up in Watts, where attending art exhibits wasn't the norm, and her work depicts the life, struggle, and history of the Latino and Black families in her community, the same community that helped her paint that wall. Her life is the subject of a new LA Times short documentary called Baca, and Judy Baca joins me now. Hey, Judy.
Hello.
And one of the directors of the documentary is with us as well, Alejandra Vasquez. Welcome to Press Play, Alejandra.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I would love to start with Judy. You know, people who live in LA or have even just visited have likely seen your work, even if they don't know it. And I was hoping you might reflect a little bit on your approach. The art you make is very public, not just the final work, but the process itself. Can you talk about why collaboration is so important?
Well, I think part of my reasoning in this, the development of this methodology for producing a public artwork, is that it's a public voice. And it's profoundly different than, for example, a painting on an easel painting, which is defined by a frame and a defined set of space. A public artwork, particularly the scale of murals that I've been working on, is seen in your peripheral vision. And you see from one side of your eyes to the other, being able to take a larger expanse. And it's also made in relatedness. It's made in relationship with the people for whom it's painted, for the people who actually participate in the making of it. Yeah. It's actually not something to be done as a solitary practice and work at a scale. You can't really paint a half a mile by yourself. It's important that you work with others. And then, of course, the question is, what others? And who? And why? And so my work has all developed looking at the place that I'm going to paint, looking at the people who surround that place and who are from that community, engaging them in that process so that the work does really become something that's related to them and is in a public process as well as creating a public image.
Right. And that's not, though, I think how a lot of artists work. I feel like you, your work, The Great Wall in particular, which is, you know, the subject of this documentary, you invited young people from troubled neighborhoods to help be part of it. That must pose a challenge, too, because you're bringing in a bunch of folks who are not necessarily artists or think of themselves as artists yet.
Well, in some cases, the people who are working with me are youth that... or it would be considered at-risk youth. But actually, there's a correlation between the communities that are economically disadvantaged and the amount of arrests and the amount of difficulty with authority. And so they kind of are partners. Yeah. So if you find a group of poor kids, you might very well find them having a history of being incarcerated or arrested or having difficulty with authority. So it works out that way. And I was interested in actually looking at the people who were writing on the walls and engaging those who wrote on the walls to actually say something more articulate, to have a bigger statement, to move from just simply, you'll see, I am here, this is my name, I live in this neighborhood, but perhaps something that was more about their culture and about their experience and might give them a sense of larger pride, a pride in the and who they are and the history and heritage of the legacy of their families.
And the land and they're on in the city they live in, I imagine, because, yeah, they have agency in that. Alejandra, I want to ask you how you came to do this documentary. Did you have a relationship with Judy's work before shooting this project?
Well, I was familiar with Judy's work, of course, and I'm a Mexican-American filmmaker, and I followed the Mexican muralists and artists, and so I was familiar with Judy's work, but I was really excited to dig deeper on her work.
So, you know, Judy has 5 decades of murals, a lot of work that you could have focused on, but the Great Wall of Los Angeles is the focus of this documentary. It's certainly one of her biggest projects. Why did you choose that as the kind of centerpiece?
Judy, yeah, I mean, it's so impossible to distill someone's career into a 7-minute film, but we really tried. And that's why we decided to focus on The Great Wall, because it's work that she's continuing today. It's one of her biggest pieces. It's here in Los Angeles. And when you see the wall, if people haven't had a chance to see it, it's really stunning. And you see a huge range of history, of culture, and there was just so much to dig into with just the wall alone.
Yeah. And there's so much amazing footage from the early days of Judy's career, of the painting of that mural. You really kind of get transported to the 70s. Talk about just finding that, sorting through the archives for that content.
Judy and her team did an excellent job at archiving everything. I mean, they gave us so much, way more than we could have ever used. And yeah, just seeing the footage from the 70s, it's so textural, it's so stunning, it's so colorful. And you really get a sense of Judy as an artist who is an activist, who's an educator, who cares about young people and is really bringing them into the process. And so that was the footage that we focused on.
Well, we mentioned, Judy, that the wall is about a half mile long, but there are plans to continue it. It's expected to expand to a full mile. Can you just talk a little bit about what your vision is, what you see as the future of the Great Wall of LA?
We've embarked on an 8-year long project, which has been funded by the Mellon Foundation. It's stages, first stages. We got all the way from prehistoric times to the 1950s in the first half mile. And now we're coming back the opposite side of the river, and we are starting with the 60s and bringing it up, we hope, to contemporary times. It's a massive undertaking, as you can imagine. We're having to do deep research. We're working with thought leaders. We're working with activists and historians and people who are advising us, community members, and drawing down information and creating a concept that is a narrative. More in intent on the metaphors and the experiences of people's lives and, you know, elevating stories that have been untold. And so our plan is to continue the narrative, to bring it back the second half of the site, and to paint it not in the river, because the last time we painted in the river, we had a major terrifying scare in which we had a flood.
Oh, wow.
And the kids went down trying to save our materials and equipment. And one of our people got washed down the channel 6.5 miles. She has lived to tell that story, and was an amazing rescue by helicopter on cables and about at Griffith Park. So she went 6.5 miles. And I said, that's enough. I'm not going to risk anybody else again. But everybody said, no, you have to keep going. And so I kept trying to think of a way we could do this work. Not in the river. It's horrible in the river. It's 118 degrees at some point. It's filled with what the kids call sewer. The sewer water.
There's a mural I know where the people all paint in the sewer. P-U, now don't get this wrong. This is just a funny song about the sewer. P-U.
And we have to move the water away from the mural so we don't slip and slide, and it's a nasty place. So we are now painting at LACMA in the Resnick Gallery, and it's an amazing experience. We have light, we have toilets, we have water, we have sort of the amenities that are human amenities we rarely have when working in the river. And we are painting about 100 feet. There's 60 feet nearly complete right now on the 1960s. So the narrative will continue. We'll be ready for the Olympics, we hope. Of course, it's questionable as you keep working on these concepts, they get deeper and they have to be further researched. But the plan is that we'll bring this to completion, and we will have an interpretive green bridge over the top of the river so that people can view it on a 90-foot expanse of a bridge, a pedestrian bridge.
Wow. Well, Judy, I mean, we've been talking about LACMA. Other art institutions have really, I think, opened their doors to you in ways in recent years that were not available in the beginning of your career. But you've also had to fight to preserve your art outside of museums, right? We've seen public officials paint over graffiti and cover up work. The Great Wall of Los Angeles is difficult to view right now. Can you just talk a little bit about kind of what that's been like, trying to be this advocate for your work when not everybody's always acknowledging it?
Well, I think there's a kind of bias, essentially. The historical bias is that, for myself, I mean, as an art student graduating and getting my master's degree, I don't know how many art historical classes I had, how much art history I studied, none of which included the Mexican muralism, or for that matter, Canadian artists that, you know, we never looked north and we never looked south. So I actually came to understanding muralism after I had already been working at it. Somebody handed me a book on Los Tres Grandes, and I immediately understood that that was the tradition that in which I wanted to work, and put myself on a train to Mexico and began to study the work that was going on in the South. Mm-hmm. So, as I said, the bias has to do with it not being serious work. If it's collaborative, it isn't the individual heroic male that is producing that work. Women don't make monuments. That's not something that is readily accepted. So I actually, when I went to study in Mexico, I was the only woman in a workshop of 26 men. So the tradition is essentially thought to be a male tradition. And also the bias in the art world was that if it wasn't collaborative, it wasn't serious work. So I think actually there's a moment of change that we're looking at people beginning to think more seriously about this work and to be inclusive of the process and understanding perhaps a little bit better the notion that collaboration, in fact, is a more difficult form than the work as an individual creator. How can you bring all of the hands together in the painting of the mural, for example, that we're doing at the Resnick Gallery at LACMA? How do those hands come into concert? How are we able to create a dance that we are, you know, in the same rhythm and in the same methodology and are able to make a work that is one work, not a whole bunch of individual hands? I think one of the questions I get asked the most is, which part did you paint? And the answer, if you can tell, I failed, right? Literally, there should be no difference between my hand and the hands of my 20 assistants. And if I'm doing it right, we are dancing together in perfect harmony.
That is beautiful. Judy Baca is an artist and activist. Thanks so much for your time today, Judy.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And Alejandra Vasquez is co-director of the documentary Baca, which is currently streaming on the LA Times Short Docs page. Thank you as well.
Thank you.
Coming up, the backlash to Beyoncé's new country music project and the pioneering black artist who laid the groundwork for Cowboy Carter, which drops Friday. Next on Press Play. This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Marisa Lagos, in for Madeline Brand.
This ain't Texas. Ooh. Ain't no hold'em. Hey. So lay your cards down. Alexis, ooh, and throw your keys up. Hey. Stick around, round, 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 round.
The countdown is on for Beyoncé's country music-inspired album. It's called Cowboy Carter, and it comes out this Friday. The cover art shows her sitting atop a white horse, decked out in red, white, and blue clothing, reminiscent of a barrel-racing rodeo queen, and holding an American flag. That first single, Texas Hold'em, made her the first black woman to hit number one on Billboard's Hot Country Songs chart. But the project has also received backlash about who exactly can make country music and how much race matters to the country establishment, all the while illuminating the genre's long history of black pioneers. We're going to talk about all of this now with Francesca Royster. She is a professor of English at DePaul University and the author of the book Black Country Music, Listening for Revolutions. Welcome to Press Play, Francesca.
Thank you so much, Marisa.
Yeah, we're so happy to have you. You know, just we don't know the whole album yet, right? But just seeing Beyoncé use this hyper-American classic rodeo cowboy imagery, listening to this twangy new song, what are your kind of broad thoughts about what Beyoncé is saying with this project?
Well, I really take seriously her comment that she's imagining this not so much as a country album, but as a Beyoncé album. To me, that signals the ways that she's very aware of the tense environment of country music for Black artists. And she sees this as a kind of historic recovery, musical recovery project, where, you know, using country idioms, using the idiom of the rodeo, that's all free game, you know, it's all fair game, and that she's playing with all of these signifiers, but also making her own music out of it.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder, like, what if you think there are even broader politics at play? I'm thinking about the cover image evoking sort of a patriotic Americana aesthetic, which is happening as we, I think, are having a bigger debate in this country about patriotism and, like, who gets to claim it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, to me, the background of Beyoncé as someone who has been proud of her Texas roots, mm-hmm. but also critical of them and critical of U.S. culture. So I thought it was kind of interesting that the flag on that album cover is cut off, you know, and that, you know, and I don't see it necessarily as a literal cutting off of the flag, but I think that there's something very decisive about the way that she's using patriotic imagery to be in, you know, I think she's in discussion with it. I don't think that she's wholeheartedly embracing it. And that to me is much more, you know, on brand for Beyoncé.
Yeah. Well, she said in announcing this album that it was born out of not feeling welcome by the country music genre and that she hopes an artist's race won't matter in the future as it relates to genres. I think we all assume she was talking about her 2016 song Daddy Lessons. This is actually Beyoncé performing with the Chicks at the Country Music Awards. Here, and you have an entire chapter in your book dedicated to Daddy Lessons, which is, of course, from her seminal album Lemonade. I mean, this was her first real venture into this country genre. Why did you write about it?
I was really struck by the ways that she is, you know, taking this very popular icon of the outlaw and kind of applies it in some ways to her own iconography and really her own feminism. In Lemonade, in the video album, you really see her making use of cowboy culture, of kind of images of Black manhood. But she's also asking, you know, the question of where these past images have taken us. And for me, Daddy Lessons also fits into the Black feminism of Lemonade as a whole. And I think that that's why it's so fascinating. And it, to me, gives also a clue of how Beyoncé might be engaging with country music, too, in a critical way, in a way that's adding a counter narrative of other forms of strength.
Yeah, I mean, she is not alone in being a modern Black country artist, talking about the struggle to be recognized by the country establishment. Yes. But can you talk a little bit about the history here? Because country music was born largely from Black Southern music and traditions. I mean, the Black cowboys are a huge historic tradition in American culture as well.
Yeah, you know, country music, before it became a commercial form in the 1930s, was really made up of all of these different threads of folk music and traditional music from, you know, all over the United States. So that centrally includes African-American blues, string music, banjo music, the music of enslaved folks, Mexican ranchero music. But when country music became a kind of commercial enterprise, which happened in, you know, 1920s and 1930s, when record labels were trying to think about how to sell LPs and how to create audiences for them, there was kind of this invention of country music as white. Mm-hmm. So the music industry really segregated this musical form, making hillbilly what became country. And the attempt was to keep the musicians as well as the fans apart, you know, reflecting the Jim Crow politics of the United States in the early 20th century.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about a woman who really is a sort of seminal artist when we talk about Black country female artist, Linda Martell. She released a country album in 1970, and this is her song, Bad Case of the Blues. If I really was a smart girl, I could turn him loose. You're letting Linda Martell performing at the Grand Ole Opry back in 1969. She was actually the first Black woman to ever perform at the Opry. Tell us a little bit about her, because she only actually released one album.
Yeah, she's just an amazing performer, you know, still alive, still with us. But it's really always been sad to me that Linda Martell only made one album, Color Me Country. She was someone who really was one of the first woman to be crafted, for a short time at least, as a country music star. But her label, which was Plantation Records, after this one album, stopped supporting her or taking her on tour and didn't cut another album with her. And it's really a loss, because in Bad Case of the Blues, you can really see how she's bringing together country music sounds and kind of dance music, especially with the blues, with the mode of kind of humor, but also like melancholy and regret, and kind of occupying the country music space in a, you know, with confidence and the assumption that country music can be used to tell stories about Black life. So Martell, you know, even though she just made this one album, she influenced a whole generation or two of Black country music artists, especially women.
Well, another artist we cannot forget about mentioning here is Tina Turner, the Queen of Rock, actually started her solo career in country music. I want to play a little of her song, Nutbush City Limits. That is Nutbush City Limits by a young Tina Turner. This originally came out in 1973. Talk a little bit about her origins in country music.
Yeah, well, you know, Nutbush is really talking about Tina's past. Her birthplace was Nutbush, Tennessee. And this song, Nutbush City Limits, was the first song that she wrote herself. And it was really important because it was telling about small town life, but I think also acknowledging the tension and the feeling of racial surveillance in small towns. So it was not like a nostalgic look at the country, definitely a complex and layered view. And then, you know, a year later, Tina set out and made her first solo album, Tina Turns the Country On, because country was the music that she liked to listen to. And it was really an album that was reflective, and to me, like, really taking on this feeling of transition, melancholy. To me, it's almost like a precursor to Private Dancer, where she's also like thinking about regrets, thinking about life choices, and but definitely using the language of country music to do that.
I love that. It's a little subversive in a way. I want to just end by asking what you think happens next. We've seen a lot of Black women really get defeated by the country music landscape. I mean, do you think Beyoncé, who is obviously a very singular artist, can kind of break down those walls?
I do think that the potential is there. And Beyoncé is someone who is very savvy about kind of using an oppositional gaze, you know, in terms of the industry, at the same time that she makes the most of it. And she also has a very strong fan base, of course. Just the popularity of these two songs have gotten people to listen to other Black country music women, especially, and Black country music artists. So artists like Rena Roberts and Tanner Adele, and of course, Rhiannon Giddens, who appears on Texas Hold'em. And that to me is really exciting. And more importantly, I think perhaps fans who may not have seen country music as their home are including it in their own like listenership. And I think that that is really promising in terms of a different kind of conversation that we'll have after, once the album comes out, and then after the album is with us.
That is Francesca Royster. She's a professor of English at DePaul University and author of the book Black Country Music: Listening for Revolutions. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Marisa.
Beyonce's album Cowboy Carter is out this Friday. This is her song, 16 Carriages. Dreams away to the summer sunset on a holy night on a long black road. All the tears I fight. 16 carriages driving away while I watch them ride with my dreams away to the summer sunset. That's going to do it for Press Play today. I'm Marisa Lagos filling in for Madeline Brand. Thank you so much for listening. It has been fun to be with you and the incredible crew here at KCRW. Jonathan Bastian, host of KCRW's Life Examined, will be here with you at noon tomorrow on 89.9 KCRW. Working all my life, you know. Only God knows, only God knows, only God knows. 16 carriages.